two-word phrases that make me feel uptight, stressed, and bring back painful memories. Presidential debate. No, I'm just kidding. Here's my list, and you'll notice a theme. Industrial arts, building projects, maintenance crew, and assembly required. Industrial arts. Back when I was in high school, we called it shop class. Mr. Green was our teacher, a very kind man, but one day he tenderly told me, "John, I would advise you not to go into the trades." Building projects. A hammer, a screwdriver, a drill. They are all dangerous weapons in my hands. Maintenance crew. I've done all kinds of tasks in summer camps over the years, but I have never, ever been asked to be part of the maintenance crew. What a blessing to all those camps. And finally, assembly required. Even saying those words caused me to panic. I will pay extra. I will pay $100 more just for the word no, as in no assembly required. As you've likely figured out, I have a lot of inadequacies and am challenged when it comes to this particular area of life. It's my limitations in building, mechanical, assembling skills, being a handyman, that makes that summer when I was a teenager so surprising. I was a teenager in Toronto, and our church was in the middle of a renovation project. The leader of the project was Mr. West, of all things, a retired shop teacher. And Mr. West recruited some of us young guys, to help with the project. If you can believe it, he invited me to be part of the group. So every morning I would ride my bicycle to my friend Keith's home, and together we would ride in to the church. Keith proved to be a wonderful builder, great skills. In fact, Keith ended up in his career being a house builder in the Ottawa area. I didn't. Part of my contribution usually involved sweeping the debris. And I think I was a good gopher. "John, will you go for this? Will you go for that?" That was about the extent of my ability. But I learned to appreciate in a deep and keen way my limitations. But there was a takeaway. There was an important lesson. Because we accomplished a great task. It was a successful renovation project. And what I learned that has influenced me in pastoral work, in our family, and in other settings, is the importance of teamwork. Teamwork. Just two powerful words that are a classic compound word that are so meaningful and significant. Teamwork. Patrick Lencioni is an expert in teamwork. He is a world-renowned authority and a world-class consultant when it comes to teamwork. He says when people get together and set aside their individual needs and focus on the goals of the whole, it's amazing what can be accomplished when things that looked impossible on paper get done. Teamwork is a case where more gets done in less time. Lencioni goes on and he argues that teamwork is that commodity. It is a sustainable competitive advantage, though it is deeply lacking in a lot of areas. It is disturbing that we haven't unleashed the potential of teamwork. But at the same time, I love that phrase, competitive advantage. We see it in the business world. You want a competitive advantage over your competitors. But in the family, we need that competitive advantage. There's a lot of threats against the family. And in the church, we face a strong spiritual enemy. We need any kind of competitive advantage. Lencioni goes on and he says, teamwork is often lacking when organizations fail, but it's there when organizations succeed. And then he comes to his big conclusion. Lencioni argues, nothing, absolutely nothing, is more important than teamwork. Now, is that true? Is that an exaggerated statement? Does it apply in every area? Is this all-encompassing conclusion relevant in our situations? When I think of an all-encompassing conclusion, a big-picture application, I think of little Becky. Becky, 5 years old, returning from kindergarten, and she said to her mom, Mommy, I have a stomach ache. Becky's mom said, Becky, I think it's just because you're hungry. Your stomach is empty. You have nothing in it. You need a snack. Well, Becky had a snack, and 15 minutes later, she says to her mom, Mommy, I am feeling better. Well, Becky's mom had to go outside to do some yard work in the backyard, and the phone rang. And little Becky picked up the phone and said, hello. It was Pastor Wilson. Pastor Wilson said, oh, hi, Becky. And Becky, having learned to be very courteous and polite on the phone, responded, how are you, Pastor Wilson? And the pastor, wanting to be open and honest, said to Becky, well, I haven't been feeling well today. I really have a bad headache. Well, little Becky didn't miss a beat. And thinking of what her mom had suggested, jumping to a conclusion, she said in her little voice, well, Pastor, I think it's because it's empty. My mom says there's nothing in it. And then a long pause, she said, I think you need a snack. Well, I'm not sure if Pastor Wilson was offended by what it seemed like Becky's mom was saying about his intelligence. And I think you'll agree with me, it's kind of amusing the way that little Becky linked her stomach ache to a headache. But it comes back to what Lencioni says. Nothing is more important than teamwork. If you're a Christ follower, you might argue, but we would say nothing is more important than God's role. But here's the point. Our God delights in working in and through teamwork. It's part of his strategy when it comes to his unfolding plan of redemption. You see it in the rebuilding of a wall in Jerusalem, but you also see it in the building up of the church of our Lord Jesus Christ. It's part of God's strategy. I recall one of God's prime men, a great leader, Billy Graham. Billy Graham, that well-known evangelist, a great leader in the church. Just before he died, he was awarded by the U.S. Congress the Gold Medal of Honor. There was great applause, and Billy Graham went up to receive the award, and he said these words, "This award is really not mine. It belongs to my team. We've been together for 45 years. I wouldn't be the man I am. I would not have had the same life if it wasn't for the team. I owe so much to them." And for the remainder of his speech, Billy Graham listed each and every member of his team. He had difficulty containing his emotions as he did so. You see, Billy Graham valued the importance of team. Nehemiah, as we're going to discover, valued the importance of team and teamwork. Our God, part of his overall strategy for us, involves the priority of teamwork. So this morning, my title of our talk is Nehemiah's Dream Team. Now, a couple weeks ago, we looked at Nehemiah learning about a problem in Jerusalem. The gates had been burned down, the wall was broken, and then Nehemiah goes into action, he prays. We've looked at Nehemiah demonstrating great leadership. He was a leader who set goals. He was a leader who made and developed plans. And he was a leader who not only led, but was willing to be led by God. Last weekend, we looked at Nehemiah as a great motivator. He said to the people, "Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem." Now today, we're going to look at this whole idea of teamwork. There are great insights. There are some really good lessons for us as we think about teamwork. Whether your team is your family, what a great way to look at the partnership you and your spouse enjoy. What a great way to look at your family as a team. In business, of course, there are many teams. It's a very popular way to view the different committees and groups in the workplace. And at church, we need to see ourselves as a team. And within that bigger team in the local church, there are a lot of different teams that make our programs and ministries possible. So if you have your Bible, I'm going to ask you to turn to Nehemiah chapter 3. This is where we are in our study, and I need to admit a couple of things. This is a very challenging part of the memoirs of Nehemiah. It's challenging because there are a lot of names that, frankly, are quite difficult to pronounce. There's a lot of details, and if you're not details-oriented, Nehemiah 3 will be a very difficult chapter for you. It reminds me of all the details we find in the Pentateuch, that part of the Bible that talks about the tabernacle. After about six chapters and all the intricate details, most of us find reading it quite a burden. Or the list of names in Chronicles, these genealogies that just are blow our mind in terms of the detail and the sheer number of names. It's kind of like that in Nehemiah chapter 3. But I'd just like to give you a sample. What I want you to do is maybe later this week is you read through the whole of Nehemiah chapter 3 just to get a flavor for the list we have here of those who were involved in rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem, Nehemiah's dream team. So I'm going to start reading at Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 1. Pastor Josh shared with me the other day the secret of reading some of these names. Read them with boldness and confidence. Say them quickly, and nobody will know the difference, but I'll do my best to pronounce them correctly. Nehemiah 3, verse 1. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. They dedicated it and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which they dedicated, and as far as the Tower of Hananel. The men of Jericho built the adjoining section, and Zachar, son of Imri, built next to them. The fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hasanah. They laid its beam and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Meremoth, son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, replaced the next section. Next to him, Meshulam, son of Berechiah, the son of Meshurabel, made repairs. And next to him, Zadok, son of Bana, also made repairs. The next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. So not everyone was involved, but most were. If you go down to verse 12, Shalem, son of Hallosheth, ruler of a half-district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. The valley gate was repaired by Hanun and the residents of Zananoah. They rebuilt it and put its doors with their bolts and bars in place. They also repaired 1,000 cubits of the wall as far as the Dung Gate. What a name for a section of the wall. The Dung Gate was repaired by Malchijah, son of Rechab, ruler of the district of Beth-Akarim. He rebuilt it and put its doors with their bolts and bars in place. We're going to stop at verse 28 through the end of the chapter. Above the horse gate, I guess this is where the horses went in and out, the priests made repairs, each in front of his own house. Next to them, Zadok, son of Immer, made repairs opposite his house. Next to him, Shemaiah, son of Shechaniah, the guard at the east gate, made repairs. Next to him, Hananiah, son of Shemaniah, and Hanan, the sixth son of Zaloph, repaired another section. Next to them, Meshulam, son of Berechiah, made repairs opposite his living quarters. Next to him, Malchijah, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs as far as the house of the temple servants and the merchants, opposite the inspection gate and as far as the room above the corner. And between the room above the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and merchants made repairs. And we ask God to bless this very exciting part of his word. I'm sure that you were just in absolute breathtaking wonder as I read that part of God's word. There are a lot of names. There are a lot of places on the wall. It's interesting when we think of the names, we think of those who are listed. You have priests, you have goldsmiths. We didn't read it, but there are perfumers who were involved. There were men, there were women. Often these people were working in sections of the gate very relevant to them, close to their houses, those who were residents in Jerusalem. But this also involved what I call the GJA. In Toronto, we have the Greater Toronto Area. In Jerusalem, there were the surrounding towns and villages. But the people there had an interest in helping out and being involved in rebuilding the wall of the capital city of Judah. It's interesting the names we don't find. Nehemiah does not list his own name. Oh, now I know there is a Nehemiah mentioned in the middle of the chapter, but this is a different Nehemiah, someone who had his same name. We don't see mention of the Samaritans. As we've mentioned already, we'll see this especially in a couple of weeks' time, the Samaritans were enemies and were not part of the rebuilding of Jerusalem. In fact, they will become the royal opposition, or as I like to say, pains in the neck to Nehemiah when it came to the rebuilding project. So I want us to pick up on some insights and observations that I think will be relevant and helpful to us. I talked at the start of the sermon about two-word phrases, and I've come up with 10 two-word phrases that I believe give us some insights into what was going on here in Nehemiah chapter 3. The first term I'd like to use is strategic leadership. We've discovered that Nehemiah was a great leader. But Nehemiah demonstrates his leadership skills very much as he puts together this dream team. It wasn't that Nehemiah came into Jerusalem and he said, "Hey, here I am. I'm going to rebuild the wall. I'm going to do it all by myself." No, Nehemiah knew the key to teamwork. A team can get more done and in less time. And this was definitely the experience back then of rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem. It was part of Nehemiah's strategy. He knew that he would need a team to get it done. And so the second phrase that I want to use is deliberate delegation. Nehemiah knew that he had to organize. He had to put people together strategically to rebuild the wall. It's kind of like the Jethro principle. You remember way back when Moses was trying to do too much all on his own. And his father-in-law Jethro said, and to paraphrase Jethro, Moses, you're going to burn out. You can't do it all by yourself. You need others. You need others who will carry the weight. You need a team. And one of the best things Moses did was put together a team, delegating some of the responsibility to them. So we see this here with Nehemiah. Based on the idea of people being involved in places of interest to them. Also, I think there would be a sense of giftedness. And I know there's tension there. When it comes to church life, thinking back about a year ago when we were talking about spiritual gifts, it's always best to deploy people in areas of giftedness. But we need to balance that off. There are times when people need to be involved in areas, even just helping in areas where they should have a vested interest. Take something like Sunday school. The ideal is to have Sunday school teachers who are spiritually gifted to teach children. But if you have children in Sunday school, I believe you have a role. You can be a helper. You can be an assistant because you have a vested interest in those children, your children, who are part of the program. I'd argue that pertains to nursery, that pertains to youth group, and we could go on through the various demographics of the church. I don't think it's either or. I think both need to be there. A third phrase would be a compelling purpose. Nehemiah had a goal. He had a vision for Jerusalem, and he articulated it well. He communicated effectively. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. There was no mistaking the goal. He did not say, hey, why don't we just hang out? And maybe while I'm here, we'll try to figure out what we can do. No, he had a goal. He had a compelling purpose that he expressed to the people, and they bought into it. They were energized by it. If you're a leader without a goal, you will soon lose any potential followers. I remember talking to a family, and it was actually the mom and dad, and their family was disintegrating. A lot of problems and a lot of issues. But what they did was they resolved to come up with a purpose statement for their family, which seemed to me at the time to be a bit over the top. But it worked. It helped their children. It helped them in establishing priorities and goals for their family. We need to be doing that as a church. Back in the spring when we talked about our core values, we talked about the fivefold purpose of this church. And we need to communicate it. We need to remind ourselves of, why do we exist? Why would you want to be part of the Byron Community Church team? We have to have a compelling purpose. I also want to use this phrase, the fourth one, modeling work. Now, while Nehemiah is not mentioned specifically in chapter 3, I can go a bit ahead to chapter 4. Here we read in chapter 4, verse 6, Nehemiah saying, so we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, and the people worked with all their heart. And then in verse 21, Nehemiah says, so we continued the work, with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn till the stars came out. At that time, I also said to the people, have every man and his helper stay inside Jerusalem at night so that they could serve as guards by night and as workers by day. Now listen to this. Neither I nor my brothers, nor my men, nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water. Oh, so much we could say about these verses, but Nehemiah set an example. He was a very hard worker. I once worked for someone back in my early 20s, and he was the boss, and he wasn't a hard worker. He'd show up for an hour or two in the morning, he'd go out for an extended lunch, and might never come back. And pretty soon, many of us started saying to ourselves, why are we working so hard when this guy who's the boss, when he's getting far more pay than we're getting, seems to be doing nothing? You need to set an example if you're a leader. And what I admire about Nehemiah's approach to teamwork is he modeled hard work. A fifth and sixth terms are just quick. Nehemiah's keen awareness. It's a cumbersome list, but he was aware. He knew who was who. He could list the names of those who were involved. And then heartfelt appreciation. I am sure for Nehemiah, what motivated him to write out this list of workers was a deep and a keen appreciation for what they were contributing and what they were doing in this task of rebuilding the wall. Another term I use is competitive advantage. It's a Lencioni term, and again, as we're going to see more in a couple of weeks' time, there was opposition to the wall. You have these nobles in chapter 3, verse 5, who weren't involved, and we're going to look at some of this opposition and why teamwork really is a competitive advantage. I like the idea that Nehemiah seemed to have, here's another term, the right people. The right people. These were people who had a vested interest in Jerusalem. They were those who were citizens of Jerusalem, or were involved in being citizens of Judah, the surrounding areas. They had a vested interest. I think back to Bill Hybels, who used to always talk about the three C's of a team. There needs to be men and women of character. And I believe these people in Nehemiah chapter 3 were people of character. There needs to be competency. Even those who maybe weren't great builders were good helpers. So there was a level of competency, and then chemistry. They seemed to work in cohesion. It wasn't a free-for-all, one person working a little over here, then a little over there, and just kind of a real mess. No, there was that kind of chemistry as they worked well together. Or are these three C's ever needed in the church? We need people on our teams who are people of character, of integrity. We need competency. We need to develop that. We need to encourage competency, a striving for excellence. And we need chemistry. Just throwing together six or eight people and saying their team is not good enough. We need to appreciate the importance of chemistry. Just two more. I use this term, privileged responsibility. Somehow Nehemiah convinced the people it was a privilege to be involved in rebuilding the wall. I remember as a young boy, we'd sing that old Gaither song, I'm so glad I'm a part of the family of God. I hope you consider it a privilege to be a part of this church, to be a member of your family, to have a job that you can go to. A real sense of privilege way outweighs a sense of entitlement. And then responsibility. You've heard it said. It's not new. With privilege comes responsibility and a willingness to carry out those responsibilities. Then finally, you belong. For most people, what draws them to a team is a sense of belonging. Belonging to the team, to the group, to the community. And I believe as people saw their names listed or a representative from their group listed, that gave them and fostered in them that sense of belonging. Those are 10 two-word phrases that make me feel empowered and energized, and I hope that you would agree with me. Patrick Lencioni has written a wonderful book on teamwork called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. Let me just list them quickly, just kind of as a bonus to you as we think about teamwork. He says a dysfunction of a team is the absence of trust. We've already talked about the importance of character. When trust is missing, it's really hard for a team to operate effectively. Not only trusting the leader, but trusting each member of that team. He talks about the fear of conflict as another dysfunction. In a good team, there's discussion, there's debate, there can even be disagreement before arriving at a really good decision. A lack of commitment, there's another dysfunction. Hey, I was recently doing some premarital counseling. At the end of our sessions, I asked the young man, who's a very smart and intelligent guy, I said, what was your biggest learning from the sessions? He said, John, one session you used this phrase, you need to be committed to commitment. He said, that really resonated with me. And it's so true on a team. You need people who are committed to commitment. If you say you're going to do something, follow through and do it. If you make a promise to your team members, you're going to do it. If you say you're going to show up for an activity, you show up. This is not only responsibility, but it is that strong sense of commitment. The last two dysfunctions, the avoidance of accountability. A good team needs to be a team where we're accountable to one another. It's not that we're policing each other as much as we're holding people responsible. It's good for us. It's good for our own development. And finally, the final dysfunction, an inattention to results. Nehemiah cared about the results. He could measure the success of this project. Come, let us rebuild the wall. So these then are Patrick Lencioni's five dysfunctions of a team. And I believe that Nehemiah was able to overcome any possibility of these dysfunctions. Now, as I close off, I just want us to focus on a very special team, and that is the church. We've talked about family, we've talked about business, we've talked about other settings, but obviously on this kind of recording, we have a special interest in the church. I think of 1 Peter. We studied 1 Peter a year ago. Do you remember where Peter says that once we were not a people, but we are now a people. Once we had not received mercy, now we have mercy. He had such an appreciation for the church, God's special team. And then we think of Ephesians, and in particular, I think of Ephesians 4:16, where the church is compared to the metaphor of the body. And Paul writes, from him, the whole body, that is the church, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. Nehemiah formed a dream team. God's strategy is to work in and through teams. A good leader needs to be a team builder. He needs to be passionate. She needs to be enthused about teams. But a good team depends on you, as each part does its work. The other day I was listening to a podcast from Edmonton. Believe it or not, it's big news that our son Mark retired from the Edmonton football team and is now in medical school. And the fellow from the radio station interviewing Mark asked him about his university experience and the highlights and some of the disappointments. And Mark shared one of the disappointments, the Vanier Cup. It was great to be in that national championship game. I remember being there. We had front row seats there in Montreal. It was a really exciting game. In my opinion, McMaster University, Mark's team, outplayed the University of Montreal. But it came down to a field goal in the last seconds. If we made the field goal, we win the game. And our field goal kicker, Tyler, was automatic when it came to field goals. It was only a 30-yard field goal, and we could taste victory. It was so close to us. Tyler lines up. The ball is snapped really well. Tyler goes into the motion, and a fellow on the University of Montreal breaks through and blocks the kick. It was crushing. It was disappointing. We lost the National Championship of Canada by 1 point. I'm not going to cast too much blame, but, you know, on a football team, it's a team, and teamwork is very important. And though most of the players on that play did their part, there was one fellow, an offensive lineman. You might go, well, how important a position is that? But that offensive line is like a wall that protects the kicker. And because he didn't carry out his responsibility, because he was kind of lacking in that particular play, we lost the game. As each part does its work. There was a hole in the wall when it came to that football game. Nehemiah made sure there was no holes in the wall of Jerusalem. It was a defense wall, protecting the people, giving them security. Each man and woman had to do his part. At Byron Community Church, each member has to do his or her part. Whether in these days it's praying, and we need a lot of prayer warriors at Byron Community Church, will you pray for this church, for the families of this church, for our efforts to reach out to the community at this time? We need your financial support. You have been gracious and faithful in that way. But moving forward, we need that kind of support from you. We appreciate those of you who do your part in making that possible. And as we look forward to reopening, I guarantee you there will be many, many opportunities for you to serve in this church community. As someone has said, if you are not serving in the church, there is someone who's not being served. So may God make you, as you think about the value of teamwork and the privilege of being part of the team, may God kindle within you a desire to be involved in team work. May God bless this message. Amen.